Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hi, I'm Rob Greaves, and it's a pleasure to bring you the penultimate program in the life and times of Simon Rashley. Born a baby boomer in the 1950s, Simon has had a lifelong career in many elements of the music industry, despite dipping his toe in and out of other careers and work over the years. Heavily involved as a vocalist in a range of bands, particularly in the 1970s, Simon also worked in record shops as a buyer and, as we learned last week, eventually started a career with Festival Records. In this program, Simon shares more fascinating stories post-festival, including his relationship with a range of local and overseas artists that includes AC/DC and Ozzy Osbourne, which came about in large due to his work as promotion manager of Sony Music. To say Simon was busy is an understatement, but he still finds time to have two daughters with his wife, one of which has an active career in Australian opera music. However, change is also a constant feature of Simon's life, and he tells of how he moved out of music into television and then the film industry, where he had a successful career as a producer. Simon also shares stories of filming in India before, yet again, returning to the music industry. We pick up with Simon providing a backstage story involving hard rockers AC/DC.
Or another classic story is backstage was AC/DC on the Razor's Edge tour. And I go up and see, go up to Angus and Brian and go, I say, oh, can I get you a drink, guys? You know, you want a scotch or a beer or, you know, gin or something? So, Angus says, you know, Simon, you know what I'd really like? I go, what? A nice cup of tea. So I think, oh, I think we've got some twinings here. Oh, English breakfast. Oh, that'd be lovely. So anyway, I really went to a lot of trouble making this cup of tea. And he said, oh, you make a good cuppa. Oh, yes, my grandmother taught me how to do it. Oh, thank you. So, yeah, you see, you know, what they're like. And then there's this other side of them. Or a classic one. Ozzy and Sharon Osbourne, you think they're like, he's a man, demonic figure, you know, Ozzy, but they've got a heart of gold. In fact, there's an amazing story where they did the children's hospital tour. They wanted to see the kids in the children's hospital. Anyway, so we're doing the children's hospital with Ozzy and Sharon, and there's this young girl who's dying of leukemia. She's only 14.
Wow.
And Lord, she was very tough. And she was a big fan of this band of that time. I can't quite think of the band's name, but she had the T-shirt on. And Ozzy, because he's like the godfather and the grandfather of heavy rock, he said, oh, I know those guys. I said, oh, I'll tell you what, I'll try and get them to give you a cheerio call, you know, to cheer you up, you know, this young girl called Fiona. So anyway, we do the rest of the tour, everything goes well. And we also did the fabulous Billy Pennell thing as well, Coffee with Ozzy. You can see him in the background in that era. But anyway, they go back to LA, and sure enough, Sharon and Ozzy ring me up at home saying, how's Fiona? You know, we're trying to get onto this guy. He's trying to get the cheerio call. And anyway, weeks go past, and nothing. They're still trying, and this poor girl dies. Ozzy and Sharon send flowers to the funeral in Ballarat in Sebastopol, all the way from LA that we arranged for them. And, that's the type of people they were. And then this guy from this band rings me at home one morning, like a week or two later, and said, oh, I've just got I've been in Japan, I'm on tour, just got the word about the girl. I said, oh, I'm sorry, mate, she passed away, but you buried in your T-shirt, your band's T-shirt. You know, so you get to see this other amazing side of artists in the record in the game. So, yes, that was amazing. You know, so most of them keep it pretty straight. There's not so much wildness going on because they can't get.
But they have to have that persona because the audiences don't want them to be normal.
Yeah, so they're exactly. Well, so they're all pretty much had this the straight side as well on the side, except for maybe Lemmy from Motorhead. He was probably the real deal at the hardware club with meeting the girls and having some drinks. But, yeah, the rest of you probably. Yeah.
So that's a very memorable part of your life.
Oh, yes, that was a really big part of it as promotions manager of Sony. So I got to look after some amazing artists and, you know, some really big media too, like major radio stations and TV stations and press and stuff. So what happened from there is that I did very well, even won Promotions Manager of the Year as Promotions Manager. Right. So I did very well. I was then promoted to State Manager of South Australia and Northern Territory for Sony. And went over there. That was a bit tougher because the South Australian market wasn't as easy to work as the Victorian market. I struggled a little bit in the Adelaide game. I did all right, but
was it also because you didn't have the same contacts as you had here in Victoria?
It was just a harder market. It was a time that during the kidding recession we had that.
Oh, as okay, well. Right. So yeah, so money's.
I should mention that during that period as well, during Sony, I got two lovely daughters. You know, so I had two daughters, Rebecca and Lauren. Rebecca is in the music industry herself these days,
right,
as an opera singer, and Lauren's an artist. So we had the early days of the girls moving to Adelaide, you know, which was fabulous for there for 5 years.
So did they, just to move away from you for a moment, but it is tied with you, obviously, the daughters, they're, especially Rebecca, the move into music, opera, was that by their choice or did you kind of encourage them?
She just came out with it herself. I think her grandmother on my ex-wife's side, Aida, she was a bit of an influence, and her sister, who Rebecca's aunt, were always talking about opera and stuff because they're big fans of it in their culture coming from Europe, because my that side of my ex-wife's family is from Malta and stuff, but they're, you know, very, very artsy, you know, classic arts sort of people. So I think it might have came from there, but she just had this natural gift. Mm. And, of course, she's done very well in the opera stakes, where she's won the Herald Sun Aria, and, you know, she was just recently in the Wagner Das Rheingold thing with Melbourne Opera.
I remember seeing that advertised.
Yeah, yes. She's done great for herself. So, yeah.
You must be very proud of that.
Oh, very much.
It's hard not to be, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It really would be.
Yeah. But you'd think with the environment of having a record company dad back then, as a little tyke, that she would have got more into pop or rock, but no, it was opera. You know, and she was getting, like, autographed things from Cyndi Lauper and Martika and people like that, and the cuddly toys that they threw on the stage, they'd come home to her, you know, because the artist couldn't take them home.
So. But often the children, our children, of any of us listening, shy away from the things that their parents really value when at a certain age. It's almost not quite a rebellious thing, but if dad liked this, I've got to find something else.
Yeah, yeah, you know? You'd think that. But it wasn't so much, she certainly had the rebellious side, you know, Rebecca, but later on as a teen, which was quite fascinating because she'd say, oh, Dad, you're into such a, oh, I like them, or, damn, I've got to find something that you don't like.
Yes.
Oh, Dad, I found some band you might like. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they're really cool. You should check them out. They're called Pink Floyd. You go, oh, yeah, I've heard of them.
Oh, bless
them all. Actually, Pink Floyd's one of my greatest regrets of the music industry. I joined CBS the week after they left town, so I missed out on that whole momentary lapse tour.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You've got other things to make up for that.
Listen to Older Voices, Living History on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Simon Rashley, and Simon is recollecting stories of his time with CBS.
What happened with that?
So I went to Adelaide. It was getting tough. I still broke some records there and did well as a team. You know, we had a good team there. But the pressure was on. So I decided to take a detour, and I actually got into the television industry from there. So I left Sony and got into the television industry. I had a particular concept that I wanted to run. This idea, because I was doing a lot of TV advertising and had a lot of connections as a state manager dealing with all the major networks and doing royalty campaigns for albums, etc. So I really got to know that business and got to meet producers. So I came up with this concept for a TV show called Body, Mind and Soul. And I thought it could be like a lifestyle show on TV. I got this team of producers together, and we started to develop a pilot and the concept, etc. And then, as it can sometimes happen in a project, some people in projects like to take control. And before I knew it, I was pushed out of my own project. But this is the interesting thing. That was going to be a national idea. So I took the idea, my idea, and repackaged it, presented it locally to Channel 7, and they took it up. So I ran this segment on like the morning show of Ann Wills. It's a bit like a Bert Newton show over in Adelaide. This Body, Mind and Soul segment, I did 120 episodes over 2.5 years.
Wow, that's...
And, yeah, so I was segment producer. I was a presenter as well as a salesperson, along with a business partner I had, a lady called Sumari. So between us two, we put this together, and it did very well on Adelaide TV for a while.
Excellent.
So I picked up some amazing skills in media, which would later come in handy for me as a filmmaker in years later, when I got into that era of my life, which we'll get to that. So I was very involved in that. I had other businesses as well that I was doing in Adelaide, et cetera. My business was starting to expand, marketing and management and stuff. So I started to move back to Melbourne. I was also doing personal development, where I was doing holding my own seminars and workshops, et cetera.
Goodness, you're busy.
So I was getting right into that scene as well. Because an interesting thing earlier on in my life, which another side story, my father, when he left the car industry back, this is after the parents' divorce, he was one of the first people to join the personal development movement. He worked for an American company called the Success Motivation Institute. And so he'd get all these samples of all these things, like books like Think and Grow Rich and Napoleon Hill and stuff like that. Psycho-cybernetics, he'd give it to all us kids in the family. We'd get right into it. So I had an early foundation exposure of the 70s towards personal development. I drank all that stuff up, which I think also helped shape me later on, that material earlier on. So it also, I realized, had my own message in that area of personal development. So I created this thing called the Majestic Life Program, and I rolled that into across into four states. I had seminars in Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane and Adelaide. Goodness. And so I moved the family back to Melbourne to take advantage of that. We're talking early 90s now, after the television show ran its course, and then one day they said, oh, we want to do something different. We've done 120 episodes, which was really good.
That's a great run for
2.5 years.
Yeah.
So we said, oh, thanks anyway. We understand you producer. So I moved on, and but I still had the interest in my mind about doing film and TV. So then we moved back to Melbourne, the family. I was doing my business, full-time business, where I was doing a bit of marketing. I was doing those personal development workshops. And then... fortunately, things were a little bit tight money-wise, and my marriage ended in around 1999. We hit the 2000s. It wasn't an easy time for me, those early 2000s, because I'd had a major back injury.
That slowed down most activity, didn't
it? Yeah, it did. So I had a major back injury, and I was in a difficult space because of... I couldn't do my workshops because...
So it's going to affect you, not just physically, but emotionally and mentally as well.
Yeah, and business-wise, I couldn't do anything. So, even though I'd moved out and had a house, et cetera. So I, had to go back home, live with mum for a bit and rebuild. And so I got into a little bit of acting and stuff. And I met a woman who was really interested in doing something in film. She'd heard about my name involved with the media from my TV show. Said, I'd like to do something like that. This is quite a wealthy woman. And so she approached me saying, do you want to do something with these skills of yours? I said, oh, well, why not? Let's do something. So we created this little media company, and I went off and learnt film editing. I got myself an Avid system and started to do productions on the side. Probably the key part of that was I was invited to go over to India and film a documentary about pollution for a company that she was investing in, and called Farnow Technologies. And Farnow Technologies were trying to bring in electric-powered vehicles into India. This is the early 2000s, actually 2000, 2001. And so I was invited there to go and do this documentary, which I did. I had all the camera gear and everything. And there's a sub-story there, just getting into India was really tough.
Why is that?
Because of there's a system in filmmaking where when you travel, you can get this thing called a carnet. It's like a passport for your gear. Yeah. And India didn't have carnet systems at the place. So I was actually up in Sydney at the time, getting ready for this trip, helping this Chinese news crew coming in, doing all this stuff. So I was acting as a producer there. And I couldn't find out, how am I going to get to India? So I went to Fox Studios and spoke to some of the guys there that were just finishing off on The Matrix, or they were getting ready for Matrix 2. And one of the guys said, oh, mate, I'll tell you now, you know, I've just come back from North Africa with Star Wars, you know, because they're doing Star Wars. And he said, I'll tell you now, we can, you know, it's easier to get you into North Africa than get you in India. They're just, it's a nightmare because they haven't got these setups. So what I did, I researched online, because the internet was around then in a very basic form, and I found out there's the Indian Custom Act of some year, and had allowed circus pontoons, mountaineering expeditions, and film crews.
Ah.
And there was this, and they had to go through all this red tape to get this pass. In the end, we just ran out of time, and I couldn't get this special permit, and had to go apply through three different Indian government departments to get it. It was just a nightmare.
Yeah, so, there's certainly no bureaucracy there, don't
so
they?
So I stripped down all the camera gear, right, just to look like a rich tourist.
Oh, God.
And we went over there, and we just did it guerrilla, you know, filming. So I went through all the slums of Mumbai and Delhi filming this pollution thing. It's online if anyone wants to see this little documentary. It's called India on the Move. Anyway, so went over there and filmed it all. And as we're there, it was just quite extraordinary. We'd been out filming in the slums all day, and we're staying at Seven Star, which is bizarre because our business contact had connections with the Indian government, so we could get the diplomatic rate at the Seven Star Hotel. So I'm in the worst of the worst slums, like in Slumdog Millionaire filming. And then I'm staying at Seven Star, and it's just bizarre. And we come back one night. We're watching the TV in Delhi, and we think, what's happening? There's this skyscraper on the screen, and a plane has crashed into the skyscraper. I thought, oh, look what's happened in America. The skyscraper's, this plane's crashed. And then we're watching it live on Delhi TV, and the second plane.
I remember that. I think most of us listening probably.
That looks like a different plane. And we realise that this must be a terrorist attack. So then it all dawned, it all came out as we're watching on Indian TV trying to do this film, that 9/11 was happening. And so we thought, we'd better get the hell out of here. So chances are we're quite lucky, because our next filming assignment after that was to go to Nepal and film at an orphanage there, which is another connection with this wealthy woman who was backing us. So I was very happy to get a Delhi.
Well, before we actually leave Delhi, most of us who haven't been to India read television, see it, have some idea about, we call it the slums.
Yeah.
Was it distressing for you?
It was really hard work. I'll never forget the smell out of my head of some of the slums I had to walk to go in and film, because this company was dealing with transport for air pollution as well as grey water management. I had to go in and film inside some of the toilets to see what the conditions were. The idea of this film that I was making was that it'd be like I was going to do a before film and an after film. I'd do the before film of what it was like before they went in. Then I'd bring in the infrastructure with the investors, hopefully, and as an after thing, I'd come back a couple of years later and show, oh, wow, look at the success this company Farnhouse done. Trouble is that these guys got treated terribly over there by so-called investors, and they've just ripped off their own idea and drove them into the ground, and it didn't eventuate because they were just wrecked.
Yeah.
You know, they had the best of intentions, but they were let down, you know, by so-called investors. So the second film didn't happen, but we did do the first film,
right?
You know, in over there. So, yeah, it was quite amazing seeing that polarity between the worst of the slums right next door to these amazing golden towers of skyscrapers, you know, in India. It was quite amazing to see those two different worlds living side by side.
In a lot of places in the world where you have that sort of dichotomy between the extremely poor and the well-off, if not extremely well-off, often leads to a lot of political upheaval. But am I right in saying that doesn't really happen in India?
Well, look, it's getting interesting at the moment with what's going on with this farmers thing, and the Indian government, there's a big dispute at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Mm. the Supreme Court in India has a big role to play, because sometimes government there gets gridlocked. The Supreme Court ends up doing a lot of the real, you know, breakthrough sort of social justice thing.
Mm.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court in India is very important in that regard. We came to realise, and we hear all the stories, you know. In fact, in this documentary, if you get to watch it, India on the Move, there's this situation where they're trying to bring CNG, which is the natural gas, you know, in their little rickshaw vehicles, and all the stuff they go through there.
Yeah.
So there's a little, you'll be able to see what red tape can do in sort of when it's driven too hard, too fast.
So you leave India and you go to Nepal.
So you just go to Nepal, just did a filming an orphanage there, which was lovely, and got to fly around Mount Everest as a part of a bit of a friendly extra thing. It's part of that trip, which is great. So I got to film a bit Mount Everest from the air, which is great. And then back to Australia, and of course the world had totally changed after 9/11.
Yes.
Like coming back to a different country, everything was different. So I still continue on a bit with the film industry. I did some TV commercials. I made some music videos for bands. Yeah, I did a bit of other work, some corporate video as well. But then it got to the point where that didn't work out for a while. My business partner, she wanted to change direction and liquidate the business. So I lost all the gear, and which is a shame. But I still managed to keep the skills. And then later on, I bought my own gear and did a bit of filmmaking on the side later on. But that part of my life was pretty much over in terms of doing it full time. And so, so then I got a tap on the shoulder from a friend. I was doing just a few day jobs here and there and certain places like Officeworks. But a friend tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, come back in the music industry." He's an old music mate from the Clements days.
Oh, goodness.
I said, "Come and join Manny's Music," so because he knew my skills. So I became a store manager and got into the musical instrument trade. Store manager for Manny's Music.
Goodness.
In Fitzroy. That was great to be back in the music industry.
I probably visited your store then.
Yeah.
In the final program next week, Simon tells of the highs and lows of the next stages of his career, from living in a storage locker to returning to university. Next week, part 4 of the story of Simon Rashley on Listen to Older Voices. We'll finish off with a piece of music from Simon's group Window View, and the track is Ladder of Life. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.